Welcome to The Spot, KALW's showcase for the best in public radio podcasts. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. On our show, we get a previous guest to ask a question of our current guest. So take a listen.
What's the last time you had a total reboot? What is different about your life now because of it?
And here's how our upcoming guest answered.
I started eating better, and I didn't drink as much wine as I had been, and I was exercising a lot, and it really did help me get through a very difficult time.
We're here with Anna Holmes, a writer and editor who has helmed Jezebel.com and written the Book of Jezebel, as well as currently writing as a columnist for the New York Times Book Review. Anna, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what was the first time you remember writing, like in an intentional way, not just like, I've got to finish this school homework, but I've got something to say?
That's a good question. I feel like there's different types of intentional writing that I've done. For example, I went home to my hometown in Northern California about 2 months ago to help my mom pack up her house, and so I had to go through old stuff. And I found a book, I kind of use the word book loosely here, that I'd written when I was probably about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old, and also illustrated, about a girl who befriended a dolphin. I mean, what more cliche story can you imagine an 8 or 9 year old writing than that? But I did it. So that was intentional, and I'm not sure if that was an assignment for school or if I was just inspired to write a little story. You know, when I came across that book, I was surprised because I didn't remember writing it, and I didn't remember writing anything for pleasure up, you know, until I was a teenager. So, but apparently I was doing it at some point.
Yeah.
I think in terms of like consistent writing for pleasure, which is to say not for school, probably happened in my late teens and then amped up a bit when I was in college. Just my sitting, you know, on my futon in, you know, some dingy East Village apartment with my 10-pound Apple laptop writing essays about whatever was concerning me at the moment, which I would, you know, sum up as guys, life, work. But, you know, I think I've just gone through waves, and I'm not in a particularly productive period right now in terms of writing for myself. Usually when I write for money. And sometimes those two things connect, in which I'm writing for myself and also I get paid. But there's sometimes when I just take assignments because I feel like I need to exercise a certain muscle. But I'm not as prolific as I would like to be. And in fact, I feel like the older I've gotten, the less prolific I've become. And I'm not quite sure why that is. It's almost like I've seized up a bit. I've suffered more from writer's block than I did when I was younger. You'd think that writing would become easier as you practice it and as you live life and have more things to say and more opinions on the world. But I feel like with me, it's kind of the opposite.
Well, I do too sometimes. But I think part of it is that you realize, and it's a fine balance, but sometimes you realize that the thing you were going to write is half-baked and
yeah,
totally not worth spending your time on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas when you're younger, you're just like, it's okay, I'm just going to write this. And there's nothing wrong with either one.
Yeah.
Unless, on the one hand, all you do is write drivel, or on the other hand, you don't write anything because it has to be perfect.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
those are the two, like, Scylla and Charybdis sides of the whole
uh-huh
writing equation.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the other thing I noticed that I realized when I went home to go kind of pack up this stuff and throw some of it away was that a lot of the writing I did in my early teens was in the form of letters to my friends, because back then we still wrote letters and put them in the mail. And I would have friends who'd maybe be away on summer vacation, or one of my friends lived half the year in Australia. So there'd be these long letters back and forth that I think were, I wouldn't call them performative, but they were as much about me as they were about the other person. And I have saved some of those letters because I would do drafts. This was all by hand.
You did drafts?
I did
Get
drafts.
Out of here.
I was very anal about my handwriting and having handwriting look a certain way and have it be consistent in terms of like the size of the script I was using. I mean, I don't know why I was so weird about this, because I actually can't write by hand anymore. I really feel like my muscles atrophied once I was given my first keyboard. But I would write drafts of letters. I would write drafts of obviously school papers, but I was especially write drafts of letters if I was sending something that was angry, which wasn't that often, but there were a couple of letters I once sent that were tell-off letters that I had to have, you know, perfect. And, you know, email just doesn't suffice. Like, I don't consider the emails that I send to be crafted in any way, shape, or form. So the lost art of handwriting and the lost art of letter writing for me are somewhat sad, because I haven't done them in a long time.
I'm a huge fan of letter writing, and I don't do it enough, but there are certain people, including my high school English teacher, Mrs. Sims, that I will write handwritten letters to. And I think it has a different tone and texture. And
sure.
If you think about all of the books that get printed by academic presses of the letters of so-and-so, mm-hmm. what are they going to do? Like, get someone to hack the long-dead email account of so-and-so?
That's a really good question.
How are they going to archive the fact that people had little conversations?
Well, the first book I ever did, which came out in 2002, was an anthology of letters written by women to men at the end of relationships. I called it an anthology of breakup letters, but I think that is maybe unfair to the actual letters in there because not all of them were calling off a relationship. Some of them were commenting on a relationship that had already ended. And not all of them were sent. A lot of them were written for the express purpose of the letter writer in a way for her to find some sort of catharsis or to find a narrative in the story of her relationship that she could then grasp onto and help understand why things had gone the way they did. So I'm really a fan of letters, and actually researching that book was great because I was not only going through those kind of previously published anthologies of people's letters, but I was looking through archives, wearing those white gloves where I was actually touching people's letters and transcribing them. And this was back, I started working on the book in 2000 and it came out in 2002. So certainly people were using
email
back
called?
Then. It's called Hell Hath No Fury. Women's Letters from the End of the Affair. And it was an incredible project to do because there had not been a collection of letters like that published before. There had been collections of love letters. And I wouldn't call these hate letters, but they were something different than love letters. There was something sad about and also exciting about looking at these letters and kind of mourning them because you could already tell that they were on the way out.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about Jezebel, which you launched and helmed and created a juggernaut of kind of new women's writing online that has been heavily praised and sometimes heavily criticized. Mm-hmm. You have not been the editor for, 3 years?
Since I left in July of 2010. So it's been almost 4 years, actually.
Yeah, but you just published the Book of Jezebel,
right.
Which was the compilation.
Yeah. When I left the site, I agreed to do a couple of branded projects. It's an encyclopedia of the world according to the sensibility of the site. So certainly there are themes that are in the book that are echoes of stuff that's appeared on the site, but I didn't really take content from the site and then put it in book form.
Right.
Because that would have felt, well, first of all, it would have been, I don't know how I would have done that, because at the time that I started working on the book, the site had been around for 3.5 years. And I mean, when I was running it, we were putting up 50 different posts a day. The idea that I would go back and read the whole site from beginning was just something I couldn't imagine doing. So I figured it would be perhaps more fun and maybe even easier in a way to commission new material. So it's an encyclopedia. I'm not saying that it's comprehensive. It's very pointed and opinionated. There's lots of stuff that's missing, but it's definitely from the point of view of the readers and the editors of the site. Yeah.
So for people who don't know Jezebel well, it's really been considered kind of like this, I guess, fourth wave feminist, post-feminist space of dialogue, where women are expressing their inner and outer selves in ways that are sometimes discomforting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, the writers on Jezebel are letting it all hang out. It's like people are letting things hang out selectively and are also aware of the idea of the gaze, of how people are being viewed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been very much part of feminism for a long time, is how do you feel gazed upon? How do you feel regarded by society, by your peers, mm-hmm. by many other people? How do you think women today in the Jezebel demographic are dealing with the idea of the gaze? I know that's a complicated question, but what I'm really trying to get at is what maybe makes young but adult women perhaps different than people 20 years older than they are in terms of how they view media, perception, body image, all that stuff.
Well, I think that they're more, in many ways, more media literate. They have the vocabulary and the tools to kind of talk about the ways in which they're represented by media. I mean, I certainly don't remember when I was a young woman that those sorts of discussions were going on. So I think, on the one hand, younger women have the tools to talk about those sorts of things. But a lot of the reason they have the tools to talk about those sorts of things is because of the internet and because of websites. It kind of jump-started those conversations, and I think the Jezebel was one of them, not the only one. But, the idea of a gaze or of being gazed upon is not something that I think is specific to a certain demographic. I think that as females, at least in the United States, and I can only speak for the U.S. because that's the only place I've ever lived, there's a certain awareness of being watched when you're a female that hits you, I think, probably around the age of 11 or 12. And part of that has to do with the kind of very complicated social relationships that you start to encounter in junior high schools. Part of it has to do with going through puberty and not feeling totally like yourself or not really understanding what's happening to you or being regarded differently by people outside of you. But, you know, I wonder if it's even more intense for young women than it was for me because of the fact that there is so much performativeness going on, so much more performativeness going on now. Because of things like the internet, because of things like Instagram or Twitter and Facebook and having to present this, you know, not always idealized version of self, but a highly controlled,
curated
yeah, version of self that even I participate in, but that is not native to me because I didn't grow up with it. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, you are. I mean, I I'm really glad I grew up before social media was
mm-hmm,
widespread.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's like, first of all, there's pictures that no one should see that never taken because you had to load film into a camera.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, also, you know, I think I had some impulse control as a kid, but I don't know that I wouldn't have gotten myself in a lot of trouble anyway, you know, on social media if it had been around when I was younger.
Well, in high school, my life was way too boring. Like, there would have been nothing for me to post. But in college, I actually was having a good time. But it was nice to have a good time without anyone taking pictures
sure.
or blogging about it or whatever, including
sure.
me.
Yeah.
Like, I could just live my life and not feel obligated to disclose anything in particular about it.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, as much as I like technology and new media and in some respects social media, you know, I think that they have a kind of negative side as well. And I'm really glad that I avoided growing up in an era in which Facebook existed. You know, the only thing that really existed was the telephone, where I could bitch to my friends over the telephone about whatever was going on in my life, or I could put things in a diary, which I never really wrote in the diary. I would always try for like a week and then I would give up, or put in letter form, or channel in kind of personal essays that still exist on pieces of paper in my mom's house 3,000 miles away. But like, they're not really going to be seen by anybody unless I choose for them to be.
So let me go back a little bit. You mentioned growing up in California.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about where you grew up, and also, did you have any culture shock moving to New York, which you did fairly young?
I grew up in Davis, which is a college town near Sacramento. I think there were maybe 40,000 people when I was growing up there, and there's maybe 60-some thousand now. It's in the middle of the Central Valley, which is very much about agriculture. All the towns around it are primarily fueled by the agriculture business, whereas Davis is its biggest industry is the university. You know, it was a safe place to grow up in, and they had good education. But, you know, by the time I was about 9 or 10, I started hating it. And I think it's because it was so homogenous. It was very white. I am not white. I did not look like most of the other kids. Things weren't said to me. I didn't feel put upon or preyed upon because of my ethnicity, but there was certainly an athletic, sporty, ponytailed, blonde, white, upper middle class aesthetic that I didn't fit into. And you know, I was always kind of torn between wanting to fit into that and then also being glad that I didn't. You know, I was aware that there was something special about me, which is to say that I was biracial, and there weren't a lot of biracial kids back then. And there was something that I liked about being different. You know, I liked having one white parent, one African-American parent, and just in the same way that there was something I liked about being taller than most people. But, you know, early adolescence, you can sometimes forget to embrace the things that make you different, and it can make you want to conform. So I think I was pretty tortured, at least between the ages of about 12 and 14. I actually remember my father telling me before I went to college something I never thought of before or even heard of. He warned me that the other African-American students might reject me because of the fact that I was so much lighter skinned than they were. And this had never even occurred to me that this was even a thing, because there were pretty much no black people, you know, where I grew
up.
You
had a very small cohort.
Yeah. that was a kind of shock to me that would even be something that would happen. It didn't happen, but it was something he was concerned about. So it was a big culture shock, I suppose, because I had not visited NYU, where I went to school, before I arrived for school. Like, we couldn't afford to send me across the country to look at the school before I actually arrived. But I was also, I think, pretending to be tougher than I was. You know, I did not admit that I was afraid to travel across the country. I didn't admit that I was afraid to go to college in general. I didn't admit to myself. I didn't admit to other people. And I think only later, you know, maybe even 8 years later after I had arrived in New York, did I start to kind of acknowledge that I'd done a bit of a scary thing by upping and moving across the country. But I was so ready to get out of there. Being here was a bit of a culture shock. It was a very different city then.
What years were you in college?
I was in college between 91 and 95. Mm-hmm. So when I moved to New York, there were still areas of the East Village that were considered dangerous.
Yeah, that was the era of the Tompkins Square Park riots.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that because there was a certain amount of fear, I don't think I was afraid of being a victim of crime. I think I was just afraid of the expanse of New York and the fact that I didn't understand how it was all put together. And because I'd come from a car culture in which a lot of the ways you started to understand your environment were driving through them, and I didn't have that here, I tended to stay very close to school or home. But, you know, the city was nothing like it is now. I mean, it was certainly, there were certainly plenty of wealthy people here then, but I feel like it is much more a city for the wealthy now than it ever was. And it's very depressing to me. I mean, it's depressing to me that the apartment that I rented in 1992 on First Avenue and 10th Street, which I shared with a roommate, and I think we each paid $400 a month, probably goes for $3,500.
That sounds about right.
As, you know, for a one bedroom. Yeah. I mean, it's just, and the reason I find that depressing is not only because it doesn't resemble the New York I love and remember, but because people in my position, I don't know that it's that easy. Like, I don't know if another 18-year-old girl from a lower middle-class family who got scholarships to go to NYU but still had to take out loans could fly across the country and live in New York and do a work-study job and take care of herself the way that I did and actually live in the city, because I'm just not sure that, like, she'd be able to make enough money to like, live in the city without financial help from a family. I basically don't think that I could do what I did again if I was 18 years old and coming to New York now in 2014.
Let me cycle back to writing. You're now writing for the New York Times Book Review. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously you have a lot of irons in the fire. But what made you decide that this was something you wanted to do after Jezebel?
They asked me. I mean, it's not a full-time job. So it's I wouldn't say I went from Jezebel to that. And I only started writing for the Times Book Review in column form early last fall. I think it was September was when the column first started. I was asked in the early summer of 2013 by the Book Review's new editor, Pamela Paul, if I would be one of eight columnists in this column they were starting in the fall called Bookends. And I said yes, because how do you say no to that? I mean, there's just I couldn't. There was a certain part of me that was like, oh, are they sure? Do they really want me to write about this? I mean, I don't really feel like I'm the right person. But I've also learned through experience to, you know, accept that I have doubts about myself, but, you know, to try stuff anyway. But once I started writing the columns, I mean, I was working with such great editors there who were so supportive and had such interesting ideas. And I really liked the fact that the way that the column is structured is that once a week, there are two columnists who write about the same subject. And I never know who the other columnist is going to be. I don't know what they're going to say. So it isn't like I can tailor my answer to make sure that it's somehow distinct and unique from the other writers. It's worked out so far that usually they are distinct and unique from the other writers, but I think it's actually kind of exciting. It's kind of like opening a present. I don't know who the other columnist is or what he or she has to say until the column goes up online on the Tuesday before it comes out in the print edition.
So tell me something that you're working on these days that we can look forward to in the future.
I don't know if you're going to look forward to it, but I have to write an essay.
You should look forward to
it. Yes, you should. You must. I have to write an essay actually this week, like a 5,000-word piece for an anthology that I think it's coming out in the fall about people who are childless. I'm not clear as to whether all the essays in there are by people who chose to be childless or if it's a mix of people who happened to be childless and some who chose to be childless. Or some people who had children and then lost them somehow. And it's weird because when I was asked to write the piece, I hadn't thought of myself at that point as being someone who chose to be childless. But I realized, I guess, that I am.
How old are you?
I'm 40. I am not disinterested in children. In fact, I like children a lot. And I like my friends who have kids. I'm obsessed with their kids. And in fact, if you put me in a room with the kids, I'll pay more attention to them than to the adults. Maybe that's why my friends like me. I'm like a free babysitter. But I really enjoy kids, and I really enjoy the ways that they think, and I enjoy seeing the world through their eyes. You know, something I would love to try someday is to write a children's book, just because they were so formative for me in terms of my curiosity about the world and the stories they had to tell. But I've rarely felt like a maternal urge. I have felt urges to take care of kids, like when they're around me, in terms of, you know, did someone hurt his knee or is someone hungry? I mean, like, certainly I have those sorts of caretaking impulses, but I've never felt like a deep seated in my womb, you know, urge to have a kid. And I mean, maybe that's not how it goes with people who do have the urge to have kids. Maybe it's not a physical sensation, but I don't have an ache for them. And I think there are a couple reasons why I don't have kids. I've never been sure that I wanted them. I don't think if I did have a kid that I'd want to have the child in New York City. I think that New York kids grow up in ways that are, you know, pretty incredible. They have access to so many amazing things. I mean, in fact, when I was growing up, I wanted to live in New York. Or the idea of New York I had, which was mostly informed by the books that I read and things like Sesame Street. they weren't necessarily...
Who doesn't want to live on Sesame Street?
Yeah, sure. Or just a kind of like an urban environment. I also know how important play was, and outdoor play and imaginative outdoor play. They didn't involve throwing baseballs. And I played sports, so I'm not dissing sports, but just sitting on, you know, a small boulder and digging in the dirt or playing with tadpoles and that sort of thing. And maybe, maybe most kids in the United States can't do that anymore by themselves, either because they don't live in areas that offer those sorts of opportunities or because of the fact that the world has become more dangerous and their parents won't let them go off and play by themselves. But there was something that was really important about being able to be free in that way.
Yeah. Well, it is time for our exquisite question. We basically get to quiz you with a question from someone who you have not met. And so we have David D. Healy from Tokyo, who has this for you.
What's the last time you had a total reboot, and what is different about your life now because of it?
Oh, my God. I wouldn't call it a total reboot, but like I had a lot of transitions this last year. And how has my life different now? Well, I'm not married. I live in a different borough. I'm enjoying living alone. I see my friends more. A total reboot. Well, what's interesting, actually, maybe I can talk about the events that led up to my marriage ending. I had up until that point been very sedentary. I had been running Jezebel, which was healthy for me in some ways, but not so healthy for me physically. And I guess maybe even, you know, ultimately mentally not that healthy for me to be sitting inside a second bedroom for 18 hours a day working. And my relationship was not doing well. And so I decided that, well, first of all, I'd quit the running the site. But I decided that it was important for me to not only get out and see friends again, but to do something good for myself physically. And at first, that just involved my walking around more than I ever had. Then it started, you know, that involved me walking for exercise. And then it involved me taking yoga classes and getting really into that. And, you know, I don't think that I changed significantly other than I became a happier person. And I was reminded of the importance of physical activity in terms of feeling like I knew myself. So, you know, I was trying to reboot my life in a way so that I could try and get through a difficult time. So I started eating better, and I didn't drink as much wine as I had been, and I was exercising a lot, and it really did help me get through a very difficult time. It was a reboot in terms of knowing that for me to survive a difficult period of transition, that I had to take care of myself in a way I had not taken care of myself in a very, very, very long time. And that sounds, you know, kind of trite because everyone says, you know, you have to take care of yourself before you take care of anybody else. But I really had been out of touch with my own physicality. And I was shocked by how important that ended up being in terms of my getting through, you know, sad, bittersweet moments.
Yeah, that's an important one. So you get to toss a question into the future.
I do? Okay, that was someone that you'd interviewed. Okay.
Yes. Anything for a person who you don't know.
What scenario or situation are you most terrified of, and why are you so scared of it?
Awesome. You'll find out the answer to Anna's question on the next episode of One with Farai. Anna Holmes, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Holmes is the author of The Book of Jezebel, an encyclopedia of gender today. She's also a columnist for the New York Times Book Review. You've You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. Catch our next installment when I sit down with the music director and DJ for the Knicks basketball team, Adam Merced, known as DJ Mode.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Thanks for listening to The Spot here on KALW. You can learn more about everything you heard on today's show, as well as many other great public radio podcasts at kalw.org.